Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Ewan Potts. Well, not for the first time, UK politics finds itself watching what's going on in the Middle East. Over the weekend, Iran launched its first ever direct attack on Israel, firing hundreds of missiles and drones and seizing a ship in the Strait of Hormuz. Israel says that 99% of the barrage was shot down and no Israelis were killed. But the question now is, how will Israel respond, and could it draw the region into a wider conflict? UK planes were involved in shooting down some of the weekend's attacks. Foreign Secretary David Cameron is calling for restraint.
If you're sitting in Israel this morning, you're thinking, quite rightly, we have every right to respond to this, and they do. But we are urging that they shouldn't escalate. In many ways, this has been a double defeat for Iran, and they've revealed to the world that they are the malign influence in the region.
So that is David Cameron speaking a little bit earlier this morning. This is, of course, something that it's not just the UK that have been speaking about, providing support to Israel. We know that David Cameron's going to be travelling to Israel in the coming days. So too is Germany's foreign minister as well. And US President Joe Biden spoke to Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday and reportedly said that America wouldn't be part of any counteroffensive. We spoke earlier to Peter Lerner, spokesperson for the Israeli military.
The malign activities of Iran is not new to anybody in the UK, in government, and of course in defence and intelligence establishments. The fact that Iran has conducted this attack on Israel is the game changer. And I was just listening to what Lord Cameron said earlier today, and he identified it exactly. They failed in their attack. And they failed in the fact that now everybody knows that they're up to no good.
I think notable that he chose to highlight the condemnation of Iran, not the call for restraint. So on today's podcast, we're going to try and answer what Israel might do and when, and how the UK might respond as it seeks to calm tensions. We'll also consider how any escalation might affect the regional and the global economy.
Well, let's get some analysis now from Bloomberg Managing Editor Adam Blenford, who's with us. Adam, great to have you on. Could you put the UK's position in all of this in context for us? What have we been hearing more generally from European and Western leaders about the Iranian attack on Israel?
So, hi there. So the Western leaders and allies of Israel have been standing pretty foursquare behind them on this, in contrast to the situation we've seen in recent weeks, where there's been regular criticism of Israel's military operation in Gaza and the levels of casualties there. This is a different situation. Though, of course, Iran says Israel's began the latest round of hostilities with its the strike in Syria, which it has not officially claimed responsibility for. Mm. But Iran then initiated a state-on-state attack. It sent fleets of drones and ballistic missiles towards another sovereign country. That kind of clears things up for international leaders. It's less of a complex, internal, layered, historical conflict that's been going on with between Israel and the Palestinians and Hamas. It's much more black and white for international leaders. They have alliances and allegiances. They want to see the Middle East stay as stable as it can possibly be, and they felt that in the end, you saw quite a lot of international cooperation militarily to team up and stop the Iranian operation. And so that's probably been taken, as I think the IDF spokesperson said there, as quite with some gratitude by Israel.
And how much do those international leaders have influence over Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel?
I mean, this is one of the key questions of international politics in the first half of 2024. We've been watching this for weeks over Gaza. If you ask that question to any of your visitors to this podcast a week or so ago, that the answer might be, well, maybe not as much. You've seen Joe Biden, US President, trying to I think the words from a few months ago was bear hug Netanyahu, mm-hmm. tried to keep him close, shower him with love when after the October the 7th attacks. Didn't really work, did it? The Israeli response was overwhelming, and we've seen, as I just said, you know, plenty of international criticism. What will be his reaction to this? That's what we're all waiting for. Biden's spoken, and now we've had European leaders and Lord Cameron this morning saying similar things, calling for restraint, not for escalation by Israel. But what we're waiting for from Netanyahu is which way will he come down? Does he listen to the hardliners in his wider cabinet, his alliances, his coalition government, or does he listen to perhaps the more moderate voices of the establishment who are in his war cabinet and he was discussing it with yesterday?
When we spoke to the IDF spokesperson, Peter Lerner, earlier on as well, he said that the IDF had put forward its range of options for that war cabinet to consider, without, of course, giving any detail of what those options exactly were. But it gives us the idea that that's, I suppose, what they're considering. How difficult a balancing act is this for the UK and for its allies as well, who want to show solidarity with Israel, but also really don't want to see this escalate further?
Yes. That you would see, I think that some of the statements that have come out this morning and indeed yesterday have that's the effort that they're trying to say. David Cameron this morning saying things like this was a double defeat for Iran. Emmanuel Macron coming out and saying that there's clearly, in his view, no need for further escalation. They're trying to make it clear that they feel that what has happened already is enough, is that, you know, but Cameron trying to say that Iran suffered a defeat there, while that's in contrast to, of course, what news organizations in Iran, state media, are saying. They're saying this was a show of strength by their military. The Israel's allies, Western leaders, trying to say that the point has been made, you know, that the line was held. And there's their view appears to be very similar, that there's no need for Israel to respond with overwhelming force in this occasion. We shall see which route Netanyahu and his government does take. But yes, those far-right hardliners in his coalition are not necessarily in the war cabinet, as Ethan, the expert on this, will have said to you earlier.
What concrete actions are open to the UK and other European countries to take against Iran? There's already talk of sanctions being ranked up, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I was looking through the list of sanctions or what's already in place on Iran. You know, Iran has been a kind of bugbear for the international system, as it were, for decades now. You know, obviously going right back to its revolution in the late 70s. But over the last 20 years or so, it's been heavily sanctioned for its nuclear program. You know, before this poking of Israel and the funding and arming of Hamas and Hezbollah, Iran was always on the minds of the international community for trying to for its uranium stockpiles, its centrifuges, its breach of UN resolutions and rules about nuclear programs, which it always denied, saying it was for civilian use only. There's a lot of sanctions on Iran already, so Western leaders will be thinking, what more could they do? The US has had sanctions on, has had sanctions off. After Trump came in, when he was president, they brought back sanctions against Iran. I think there potentially is some wiggle room around the treatment of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the military establishment there. Are they designated as terrorist organizations similar to Hamas? That's something that the EU, I believe, hasn't done before. So there may be some wiggle room, but Iran has been living with sanctions for a very long time. And we've also seen with Russia in recent years that sanctions, very heavy sanctions, were imposed. The Russian war effort continues. So there'll be a question for Western leaders on what might be effective.
How difficult is it for Western leaders to separate their support for Israel in this instance and the criticism that we've heard from many leaders over Israel's conduct in Gaza?
Well, they might say that the response is in their actions. But by mobilizing on Saturday night and collaborating in the days ahead of that, before, as this strike was being really quite carefully choreographed, right? The Iranians made it fairly clear there was a lot of back-channel diplomacy. This was not a surprise to intelligence services. By standing with Israel and scrambling the jets, working, you know, even you see that cooperation across to Jordanian airspace and other players in the Middle East. We've seen the Saudi and Iranian governments speaking this morning, as we reported earlier. There's a lot of different angles here, but instead of the tone of concern and criticism which has been evident over Gaza, by working together and standing with Israel against this large attack by Iran, they would probably say that's the demonstration of their support, and perhaps they might leave it there and show that, you know, it's look at what we do and not so much what we say.
Where do you think Iran sees this going? Was this simply a matter of saving face? Is Iran prepared for this to escalate?
I don't want to speculate too much. The Iranians and the Israelis have been sort of existential foes for many, many years. You know, the Iranian theocratic regime has been very keen to say, you know, death to Israel, death to the US for decades now. The Israelis have various options for how they might respond. They don't have to respond with an overwhelming show of force. They have previously been implicated in significant cyber attacks. The spark for this was a strike in Damascus that was more of a covert operation and not owned. So Israel can respond in various different ways. Iran does have a very large military and missile arsenal. It has militias and proxies such as Hezbollah with many more thousands of warheads much closer to Israel. They have different options for response or escalation at different ways of doing it. And there will be a lot of attempting to either save face or show that each side has achieved some various achievements and shown deterrence and shown strong in the face of its enemy. I mean, it's not easy to say where it would go yet next, but there's plenty of options either way.
Yeah, and a very complex situation in the coming days as well for diplomats and for leaders in the region as well. Adam Blenford, Bloomberg Managing Editor, thank you very much for joining us with your analysis on that. And as Adam was telling us, it's not just politicians in Westminster who are watching these events in the Middle East closely. G7 leaders, the UN Secretary General, among those who've called for restraint from Israel in response to Iran's attack. We've been discussing this with Julie Norman, who's Professor of Politics and International Relations at UCL. She's also Senior Fellow in the Middle East at the Royal United Services Institute.
We obviously heard a lot of calls for restraint yesterday from the G7, from the UN. But at the same time, Israel's war cabinet was meeting, and it was also discussing what would be the scale and the timing for some kind of response. From Israel's perspective, this was such an unprecedented attack that most in Israel feel there needs to be some sort of response to this. But you're right that what that response looks like can really run the gamut. It can be strategic patience, where you wait and do something further down the line that might be smaller in scale. It might be something targeted at a proxy, or it might be something directly targeted back at Iran. And I would note that this would not be the first time Israel would have engaged in actions in Iran. They have carried out over a dozen targeted assassinations, cyber attacks, these kinds of things, especially related to the nuclear program. But something that would be more of a military strikes and military targets would be different and would be an escalation.
But it is the first time that Iran has attempted to strike Israel directly in this way. Iran has called the strike a success. What do you think Tehran's aim was with this strike against Israel?
Sure. So this was certainly a very public display of an attack on Israel. You know, over 300 missiles, drones, you could see them on TV, this kind of thing. At the same time, I would note that Iran did sort of telegraph that they were going to be carrying out some kind of attack days in advance. The type of weapons that they used were relatively slow-moving drones and missiles that, again, were announced at their launch and had several kind of hours to be tracked. So the fact that there were not significant casualties, significant damage, I think was one way that Iran could get a very public display of their resistance, but without incurring massive casualties on the Israeli side that they knew would severely escalate things in the region. So I think this was Iran trying to also find a middle road, though, again, 300 missiles and drones at another country, unprecedented against Israel, was certainly a major step.
How much of a concern is Hezbollah in all of this? Israel struck further into the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon after the barrage of missiles that came from Hezbollah over the weekend as well. Is that the key axis to watch for further developments now?
I would say it's been the main area and border to watch. And again, there has been cross-border fire and activity since October 7th between Hezbollah and Israel on that northern border. Again, I think if Iran was trying to put complete pressure on Israel right now, they would have activated Hezbollah. They instead are keeping Hezbollah more in a deterrence sort of mode. But I do think that if things continue, we probably would see Hezbollah drawn in, and they do have very significant and I would say sophisticated capabilities that Israel has for a very long time seen as a major threat. So that's certainly one area where we're hoping things do not get further escalated.
Do you think that the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, could have coped with the Iranian attack without the allies, without the US, the UK, France, and Jordan?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say the majority of the 300 missiles and drones were intercepted by Israel's own Arrow missile defense system. But with that said, to have the complete kind of protection against that kind of barrage, it really was necessary to have this coalition and a very, again, unprecedented coalition of not only the U.S. and the U.K. and Israel, but also Jordan and, of course, France also. So a different mix of states who contributed to this defensive posturing.
Julie, who could broker a de-escalation of these tensions? Is it up to the United States to be able to take a lead on this, or is it players in the region that could start those conversations?
I think it's very important that the U.S. is saying what they are saying to Israel right now, though, again, we did not see those words of caution taken into account in the Gaza war. So the extent of leverage that the U.S. has on Israel in this regard, I would say, is yet to be seen. But in terms of trying to de-escalate with Iran, there's a lot of different states who are also engaged in diplomacy on that side, including different Arab states, including, again, intermediaries from the U.K. and European states. So I would say right now it's pretty much all hands on deck. Anyone who has leverage with either of these two key actors trying to say, look, everyone's made their point. We really can't have the region and the world slide into a major war.
Indeed. Where does that leave the war in Gaza? Hamas rejected the latest ceasefire plan. In terms of, what Israel does next in Gaza, how do you think that is affected by what happened over the weekend, Israel's planned Rafah invasion incursion?
Yeah, I mean, all these things are obviously intertwined, and Gaza has seemingly off the radar for the moment as everyone is focusing on Iran and Israel. But the situation there has not changed. It's still just as devastating as it was a few days ago. And so I imagine attention will swing back there pretty quickly. But I think what this does do from Israel's point of view is slow some of the criticism that they were getting from the United States, from European states about perhaps pausing military aid. Israel now can say, look, this is why we need that kind of military support to continue. This is why security is an issue for us. So I think from an Israeli point of view, it puts them in a bit better light. But at the same time, the Gaza war has just, obviously wrought so much suffering on the ground. We see a ceasefire that's completely stalled, the ceasefire negotiations, and that's from both Hamas and Israel right now. So in terms of where that goes, again, I think a lot will depend on what moves Israel decides to make with Rafah, but also just what other actors are able to do to unblock that stalemate.
That was Julie Norman, Senior Middle East Fellow at RUSI, speaking to Caroline Hepker and I a little bit earlier.
Well, often the most direct consequence felt in the UK from unrest in the Middle East is higher oil prices. But interestingly, although we saw a spike on Friday, prices are actually lower than they were before the attack.
Yeah, so Brent crude, which is the international benchmark for oil prices, was above $90 a barrel on Friday on expectations that there would be this Iranian response to the attack on the diplomatic compound in Syria. But it seems that Israel's success in repelling the attack has given the market some pause about this. Of course, there remains a possibility that if there's an escalation, prices could shoot higher. Speaking to us a little bit earlier, Bill Farran-Price, senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute of Energy Studies, said that for now, those fears seem to be contained.
It's certainly a gloves-off moment for Iran and Israel, and the first time that Iran has directly attacked Israel and not through proxies. So it's significant from a geopolitical perspective. But as long as Israel is uncertain about the scale of its response, and its allies are certainly lukewarm on any sort of response it should make, I think the emphasis right now is on containment. And I think that's why we're seeing some sort of muted response from oil markets this morning. There's not a great deal of expectation that this is suddenly going to erupt into a full-scale conflict, as some of the commentators have warned of. And I think that's why I think we've seen this so many times over the decades before. Middle East tensions are always concern oil markets because of the concentration of oil production in the Gulf. But at the end of the day, they very rarely translate into major high volume impacts on supply.
Mm. Okay, yes. It is also the issue. It's not just that Iran is a major global supplier, but it's also the risks, as you say, around shipping and the Straits of Hormuz. What do you see as the biggest risk to energy supplies at the moment?
Well, of course, we've seen that Iran is capable of disrupting shipping through Strait of Hormuz. We've seen that their allies in Yemen, the Houthis, have done the same in the Red Sea, and that's had an impact, obviously, on LNG and other shipping as well. But this is not high volume stuff. I think possibly one area that Western powers might look at is trying to tighten sanctions again on existing sanctions on Iran's oil exports. But in an election year, it just doesn't seem likely. The inflationary impact of higher oil prices is of concern to them as much as anything else. I think it's what's actually probably what's more likely to have an impact over the next couple of quarters. If this conflict is contained, as most people seem to think it will be now, is the uncertainty of the OPEC Plus cuts and how long they're extended for. And of course, also Russia's supply, which has started to go down under the impact of some of the attacks from Ukraine.
I'm curious to dig into that, though. How could an escalation affect the OPEC Plus decisions around the extension of those supply cuts?
That's a really good question, and OPEC Plus's strategy has been to keep everybody guessing from quarter to quarter, even smaller periods of time. So it seems more likely to me that they will continue with that strategy, but I think that they'll be content to see prices around about the $90 to $100 level. That seems to have been a sort of a target area. Although they're never explicit about that, that seems to be the implicit preferred area for oil prices. And I think if you look at the balances, we're in a deficit at the moment. You know, oil OECD oil stocks remain well below the 5-year average, and that now is set to continue because of OPEC Plus action through the rest of, well, at least into the fourth quarter. So markets are tight anyway. I think you can overplay the impact of this latest Middle East confrontation on oil itself. But like I say, the caveat is Israel probably will respond, and that could provoke some more volatility, at least in the short term.
Okay, so additional volatility. I mean, how would you compare this situation to previous instances in terms of Middle East tensions? Is this sort of quite a typical reaction? It did seem that oil markets became, you know, a lot calmer quite quickly, recovered fairly swiftly.
Well, yeah, actually, it reminds me of when we think back to the attack on Saudi Arabia in 2019, that provoked a considerable uptick in oil prices, but it was quite short-lived. And in that case, there was actually a short-term impact on Saudi supply. So I think the to some extent, oil markets have become more inured to this kind of political instability. It's become a feature of our world over the last few years. And I think until they actually see barrels being taken away from the market, I think we'll probably see a limit to the sort of froth that we've seen over the last few weeks in the build up to this.
That's Bill Farren-Price from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies speaking to Carolyn Hepker and I a little bit earlier. That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcott and our audio engineer was Sean Gostomachia. I'm Ian Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.